As you may recall, if you've been here, as most of you have, on Sunday nights recently, we've been studying about the eldership, and we've gone through several topics involving the eldership, and we were ready to proceed with that study here tonight and now go into a different aspect of it, focusing in on the qualifications of the elders. We've looked at the duties and responsibilities that elders have and their authority and those things, the arrangement that God has made for the church and what the elders are and their overall purpose and those things to get us geared up for understanding these qualifications in terms of the reason that God has put the elders in their position in the first place. If we don't really understand the overall duties and responsibilities and the authority that elders have in the church, it's really going to be difficult or impossible for us to fully understand the qualifications that the Lord gives in His Word for the elders in the church. Well, when we say that there are qualifications for elders in the church, then we're speaking about some things that elders must have, some qualities that they must possess, qualifications they must meet in order to be suitable for the office. And if they're not, if they don't have all those things, then they are not qualified for that particular office, and they cannot hold that position as an elder in God's church. So there are some must-haves. There are some qualifications that each one must have in the eldership for each one of those office holders to be qualified for their job that they have in God's church. Well, these qualifications are given by God, not by man, and they're found in the New Testament really in two different places. 1 Timothy chapter 3, 1 through 7, and then also in Titus chapter 1, 5 through 9. I mean, those are the two passages where the Lord outlines and gives the qualifications for those who will hold that office. And they're very clear. It's worth the time that we take to go through and study these things. We're not going to be able to go through all of them tonight. And it's a little bit challenging to go through all of this in terms of, well, how do you approach it? Or, I mean, are you going to go 1 Timothy 3 and then Titus 1? Well, you have some of the qualifications, as you would expect, we're going to find in both passages. And then also some of them fit into categories. So we're going to try to treat this in an organized way. And we're going to start as a basis. For the most part, we're going to go through 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verses 1 through 3 and those qualifications. And we'll tie in some of the parallel qualifications that we find in Titus 1 that fit those ones that we're seeing in 1 Timothy 3. And we want to get the reason we're doing it that way is because Titus 1 almost leads off with the qualifications that involve the elders' family. And I want to treat that really as a separate topic. Will probably be a lesson in itself. And so I want to look at a lot of these qualifications that aren't on that particular subject. And so 1 Timothy 3 has a lot of them that come before what he teaches about the qualifications that concern their families. So we're going to start there and try to approach it that way. But we'll try to tie in the ones from Titus 1 that fit in or go along with the ones that we're seeing here in the first part of 1 Timothy 3. I'm hoping this is not going to be a dry topic. If we have our minds where they should be, this no topic from God's Word should be dry. Nevertheless, we are going to have to go through a lot of words and some definitions, and we'll look at some different examples of how those words are used. That may not be as exciting as some of the other things that we study. But again, if we really are thinking about what we're looking at and how important it is, then we should enjoy this. We should enjoy the digging in, and that's what it's going to be. This is going to be some work. We're going to have to dig in and really look at these things. Well, why is that important, for one thing? Well, how many places have you seen where people wear the title of elder as an elder in God's church, but when you look at the scriptures, they're not qualified? And what result do you have? I mean, you can look around and see the kinds of things that have happened in the Lord's body in so many places because men that are appointed as elders, the congregation really doesn't understand what the office is about. The ones who are appointed elders don't really understand that. Nobody really understands the qualifications like they should. And then you have people that are in there doing a lot of damage and not doing the good that they're supposed to be doing. We don't want to have that happen anywhere, of course. And at some point in the future, Lord willing, we will have those have men that are qualified here. And that should be the goal of every congregation. But we would never want to have here a situation where we don't have qualified elders. Which is worse, to have no elders or to have unqualified elders? It's just not a situation where we want to just put anybody in there and say, well, now we got elders, and just not have an understanding or go by the qualifications God has given. That creates a real problem. So let's go into that with that appreciation for the importance of this, and that we're wanting to understand this so that, number one, if we are seeking to reach that point ourselves, whether it's as a man with the goal of one day being an elder, as a Christian woman with the goal of one day being an elder's wife, or as children of helping the father to be qualified for that office. I mean, there are many ways in which we can be involved in that in a direct manner. And even as a congregation, wanting to understand what God wants the elders to be striving for. Also, from the standpoint of Christianity, how many of these things are we going to study that God wants an elder to be that's not good for all Christians to be? And so we're going to have an opportunity to learn about righteousness and things that God approves of and that God wants us all to be. Now, for an elder in the church, it's a requirement. They cannot hold that office if they don't meet those qualifications. But if it's good for someone as an elder to have those things, then aren't these good things for us all to understand and be striving for? So there's a lot of ways in which this is a very profitable subject to be studying. Well, as we look at now in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, he says, this is a true saying. Now, he's leading off right here. This is a true saying. And we find that phrase used a lot in these epistles, 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Those three books were written about the same time, all of them written to young men who were serving as evangelists, Timothy and Titus. And inspired by God through Paul the Apostle, we find a lot of common subjects in those books. We also find some common phrases in those books. This is one of them. This is a true saying. It's a faithful saying, literally. We see that a lot in 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. Well, here is another one. This is a faithful saying here, that if a man desire the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. All right, now he's using here that word bishop for overseer, and that, of course, we understand is talking about the elders in the church, as we're going to see those words used back and forth, particularly when we go to Titus chapter 1. So this is not talking about a different a job or different office from the elders in the church, not at all. It's the same thing. And in fact, in Titus chapter 1, verse 5, he commanded Titus to set in order the things that were lacking and ordain elders in every city. And then in verse 7, he says, for a bishop, an overseer must be. So he uses those words interchangeably in the passage in Titus, making it clear this is talking about the same office. So one is really approaching it from the standpoint of describing the office holder in terms of where they are in life. This is an older man. And the other word, overseer, is really approaching it or describing it from the standpoint of what their job is about. So an elder is an overseer. I mean, that should not be that difficult to understand. But we do need to be clear that this is the same office. An elder in the church, or what he calls, is translated bishop here, an overseer. Now, we tend to use the word elder when we're talking about the word elders. We don't frequently talk about we have bishops in our congregation. Would that be an unbiblical term? No. But what's the reason why we tend not to do that? Well, would it be unscriptural if we put instead of out in the front there with the on the front there with where we have Church of Christ, the letters out there, if we had Church of God, would that be unscriptural? Not at all. In fact, that term for God's church is used in Scripture even more than when he refers to his church as the Church of Christ. But they're both equally scriptural. It's denoting whose church it is. And what is God's is the Son's. And so this is Christ's church. It's God's church. Well, it would be scriptural for us to put that on our sign, but we tend not to. Why? Well, unfortunately, the use of the term has been corrupted. That's a sad thing, but we know that there's a very large denomination that uses that term and for themselves and practice and do things and teach things that aren't according to the New Testament. So it's not the true New Testament church of God or Christ, even though they're using the term. So they got a right name for the wrong body. But unfortunately, it confuses things then. But we want to understand when he says bishop here, literally it's an overseer. There's nothing wrong with that term when we're using it in the biblical sense. But what do we know is a fact? I mean, out there in the denominational world, there are those ones that are appointed as bishops, and it has a certain connotation to it that doesn't fit the New Testament teaching, so we tend not to use that. But there's nothing wrong with the term. It's talking about an overseer, which is what an elder does. Anyway, so he says, if any man desire the office of a bishop, of an overseer, he desires a good work. Speaking about the elders. What is the first qualification for an elder? Well, here it's having the desire for the office. And that is an important qualification. Everything else follows after that. Would it affect the way in which someone was exercising their authority in that office, the eldership as a whole, if you have one or more than one of the office holders that are not desiring that office that they're holding? I mean, that's going to affect the way they do their job. It's important that they have a desire to do their job. Well, what does that word desire mean? It's a word that literally means to stretch oneself, to reach out after. It's used in a couple of other places in the New Testament. One of them in 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 10, where he speaks about the love of money being the root of all evil. He says, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. That word coveted after there, that's not the common word for covet. It's the same word to reach out after, to stretch oneself for. So here it is, not just a light word. It's when you desire something that you're willing to reach out and stretch to get it. And so here, of course, we know a lot of people are willing to stretch a long way to try to get money because they love it. Well, that's a wrong thing to be reaching after, desiring. But the office of an elder, same word. But that's the kind of desire that a man needs to have for that office, that he's reaching out for, stretching himself to have that. So it's not just a casual, well, okay, I guess maybe I should want to do that. No, this is something that we really should be striving for and desiring if we're wanting that office. Same word is in Hebrews 11 and verse 6 when it was describing those faithful ones of old that are examples of faith that were desiring a better country. Verse 16 of Hebrews 11, it says, now they desire a better country that is a heavenly, wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city. These ones who were seeking a country, not an earthly one, but they were stretching themselves for, reaching for, striving for a better country, that heavenly city, talking about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and these other faithful ones. Well, there's a good connotation, but it's in that same way, same word there, that we should be desiring that better country, that heavenly country, somebody who's going to be holding the office of an elder needs to be reaching for, desiring that office in that same way. It's rather helpful to look at some of these words and how they're used in other places that can really instruct us in the way or the manner in which we're supposed to be doing things. We can see that's a very strong word. Not only that, though, if a person doesn't have that desire for it, what's going to end up happening? And let's look at a couple of scriptures along these lines. Hebrews 13 and verse 17. And even somebody who desires the office and holds it, they can be discouraged in the way they are ruling by the ones they're ruling over. And it can affect the way they exercise their authority in a negative way. It can turn them sour where they really don't want to do it anymore. And that's why the congregation is instructed to submit to and obey the elders so that they are able to rule in the right manner. Hebrews 13:17 says, "Obey them to have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you." So they may go into it with that desire, but they may just become full of grief, having to deal with the members that won't follow what they're doing. And that would be a terrible thing. That's why the church has its responsibility towards the elders, as well as the elders having responsibility to the church. If they can be discouraged and then end up serving with grief, which is unprofitable for the church, if they could become that way, what if they don't have the desire for it in the first place? I mean, they're going to be ruling in a way that's going to be profitable for the church if they don't really desire that office. It's pretty clear that they wouldn't. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2 says, "Feed the flock of God." And he's speaking to the elders from verse 1. Peter also was an elder himself, verse 1 says. "But to these other elders," he says, "feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind." So there again is that type of attitude the elders need to have in the way they rule. "Neither is being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock," he says in verse 3 of 1 Peter 5. So the manner in which they rule is going to be greatly affected by the way they view the office they're holding. And so they have to have a desire for it so that they are doing their job with joy and doing it in the right way. Well, there are lots of things that we could do and just do because we feel like we have to. There's a difference between doing something because you are constrained to or you have to versus being willing to do it and desiring to do it. Paul talked about this in his preaching, concerning his preaching and the work he was doing as a preacher of the gospel. 1 Corinthians 9, 16 and 17. "For though I preach the gospel, I have nothing to glory of, for necessity is laid upon me. Yea, woe is unto me if I preach not the gospel. For if I do this thing willingly, I have a reward. But if against my will, a dispensation of the gospel is committed unto me." Well, he said he was constrained, it was necessary for him to preach, but he was doing it willingly. Even though he had to do it, he still was willing to do it. And there was a difference in terms of how the Lord was going to respond to him with what he was doing by the willingness that he had to do that work. Now, what's the bottom line with some of these positions of authority that we might have in life? If you really don't want that, then don't do it. Now, there's some things we don't have a choice about. I mean, we can't say, well, if you really don't like going to school, just don't. I mean, you have to go for at least a certain amount, so you don't have a choice there for a while. And there's also some other things too that we really don't have a choice about working. If a man doesn't work, he shouldn't eat. Of course, that's what the Lord tells us in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. But we have to work. But of course, then what do we choose to do? Is how much pleasure is there in the work that we do if we can't stand the job we're doing? And it helps a lot if we are. If we're doing something that we like to do and that we're willing to do it. And the attitude we have towards anything that we're doing, if it's out of willingness, it's going to be much better for us than if we're doing it simply because we feel like we have to. But the bottom line is, if somebody really does not want to take on that responsibility as an elder, should they hold the office? and they really shouldn't then. But then again, if somebody is capable of meeting those qualifications, should they be trying to reach that qualification of desiring it? If there's someone that God could put in a position to use them well as an elder in his church, that's a good thing to desire. And that's his point there in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1, that he's desiring then a good work to do when he desires that office. He desires a good work. Well, we should desire good works. And that's a very good work to desire. So anybody that has the potential of reaching those qualifications to be able to serve in that capacity at some point, that goes along with it. Strive for having the desire as well as for having all the other qualifications. But if you just don't have that desire, then you're not qualified. So that's really number one. In Titus chapter 1 and verse 5, we also want to take note of something else that goes along with this and the rest of the qualifications. In Titus 1 and verse 5, he says, "For this cause left I thee in Crete, that thou shouldest set in order the things that are wanting, and ordain elders in every city as I had appointed thee." Verse 6, "If any be..." And he goes on from there to talk about being blameless and all the other qualifications. But if any be, he says, ordain elders in every city, if any be. Now, does he say ordain them, period, no matter what? That's not what he said. He says ordain them in every city, if any be, and he gives all the qualifications. What does that tell us? They have to have the qualifications. And you'd think that should be obvious, but it's hard to believe it was 20 years ago, but it was. I remember 20 years ago we were dealing with a situation in the church where somebody was saying, "We've got to appoint elders, period, even if they're not qualified. That you must appoint them." No, that's not what the scriptures say. He says appoint them if they are. And then he also approaches it on an individual level. And some have argued, well, as long as the eldership collectively meets all the qualifications, each individual elder doesn't have to meet all the qualifications. Some have actually argued that point too. But he's dealing with it from the standpoint of the singular, of the individual. He doesn't say if they all together be. He says if any be. So that means each individual elder has to meet all of the qualifications to be able to be put in the office. And so not only is the eldership collectively going to meet all the qualifications, but each individual one must. And that word must is also used a few times, as we'll see, Lord willing, in this study. So the desire has to be there. It's a requirement for each individual elder for that qualification as well as all the rest of them. Well, let's proceed and see what we see next here. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 2, "A bishop or an overseer then must be." Well, there's the first time we see that must. And that word does mean exactly what it's translated in our English to be. It means must, necessary. It is necessary that the one who is an elder meet these qualifications. And the first one he gives there is blameless. This word here, and it's kind of interesting because the word blameless we read also in Titus chapter 1 and verse 6. We saw it a second ago. If any be blameless, it's the first one in Titus 1. And it's also the first one here in 1 Timothy 3, 2. It's interesting. Blameless is the first qualification of both passages. However, one of the interesting things is it's two different words. But of course, as you'll see, if we look at the definition and the use of the words, there are similarities between them. But this word here in 1 Timothy 3, when he says blameless, it means literally inculpable, where you can't be blamed or rightly accused of a particular thing. Similarly, the word in Titus chapter 1 means literally unaccused. So they are close in meaning. A little bit, especially if you have some interest in the medical field at all, which obviously I do. The word here in 1 Timothy 3, I'm not going to give you all these Greek words, but I find this one interesting. It's an epileptos. And the first part with the and means not, but epileptos. What does that sound like? Epilepsy? And it means to seize. And that's where we're at for a seizure. That's where the word epilepsy comes from in English. So, but here it's in the sense of being seized from the standpoint of being able to be accused of something. So it's not to be able to be seized upon that this person is guilty of some wrongdoing. So it's kind of interesting. Some of these word studies get pretty interesting, well, at least for me. But if that doesn't mean anything to you, that's fine. But we'll just pay attention to the definition. But we shouldn't be able to be seized by anybody to say this person is guilty of some wrongdoing. And again, if that's good for an elder in the church, well, shouldn't that be our goal as a Christian, period? We should all be striving for that. But this is a must for an elder, as he says. They must be blameless. Well, let's look at a couple of other places where this very word is used. Later in the same book, 1 Timothy 5 and verse 7, when he's talking about widows in the church that are widows indeed, that is, they are worthy of being supported financially by the church when they don't have any other means to be helped. And he says, let them be enrolled if they meet certain qualifications. And it's kind of interesting, but so here's a widow's qualification, one who's worthy of being financially supported by the church. In verse 7, he says, these things give in charge that they may be blameless. So he uses the very same word. Here's an older Christian woman that no longer has a husband, does not have anybody to care for them. But one of the things that she should be as a Christian woman is somebody that can't be accused of some wrongdoing, that nobody can seize her and say, look, she's done this and she's guilty of that. So there's that same word again. Then in chapter 6, in verse 14, after telling in verse 13 that after being given this charge verse 12, to fight the good fight of faith and lay hold on eternal life, he says in verse 14 that thou keep this commandment without spot, unrebukable until the appearing of the Lord Jesus Christ. That word unrebukable, same word that's translated blameless as a qualification for the elder in chapter 3 and of the widow in chapter 5. Unrebukable. So we can see that we should all be keeping God's commandments unrebukable. So this is a word that's generally applied to Christians. It has a particular application for widows indeed in 1 Timothy 5 and for elders in God's church in 1 Timothy 3. Again, to meet that qualification, though, elders are going to have to be very careful about their conduct, as all Christians should be. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 22, if we're going to avoid, as a Christian or as an elder, to be accused, to be seized upon, accused of some wrongdoing, we're going to have to be very careful that we stay away from anything that might get us accused of something. 1 Thessalonians 5:22 says, abstain from all appearance of evil. That is good instruction for us all. That will help us to be stay out of trouble and to be able to be accused. Because some may, just by our being somewhere we shouldn't be, we may not actually be guilty of something. But if we're at the wrong place at the wrong time and we have some choice in the matter, then we may end up finding ourselves accused of something which we've really set ourselves up for by a poor choice about being at a certain place where there is an appearance of evil to it. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. We do have to keep in mind, though, that this is not talking about being falsely accused. That's a different situation. And as Christians, that's going to happen. In fact, in 2 Corinthians 6 and verse 4, he says in verse 3 how we are to give no offense in anything, that the ministry be not blamed, but in all things approving ourselves as the ministers of God. And then he goes in and we have a list of things ways in which we are to show ourselves approved of God as his servant. Very good things to study along those lines there in that passage in 2 Corinthians 6. But verse 8, as part of that, he says, by honor and dishonor. So we're approved as God's ministers by honor and by dishonor, he says, by evil report and good report, as deceivers and yet true. Well, is he saying we're supposed to be all of that? Well, obviously not. But what's he talking about there? Well, for the good, for the righteous, for anyone who loves God and loves things that are and loves righteousness, they should look at us and testify that we are true, and give a good report of us, and then that would be by honor. Now, those who hate the truth and those who hate righteousness, what should their opinion of us be? And what might they be saying about us? In that case, then it's the evil. We'll be approving ourselves of God by the evil report, by the dishonor, and by the accusations of being a deceiver when they're false. So it's interesting to kind of see that side by side, much like we also see in the Sermon on the Plain in Luke 6. As you may recall, in Luke 6, 22 and 23, remember what Jesus said there about when people speak evil about us for Christ's sake? Luke 6, 22 and 23, "Blessed are you when men shall hate you, and when they shall separate you from their company, and shall reproach you and cast out your name as evil for the Son of Man's sake. Rejoice ye in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for in like manner did their fathers unto the prophets." So here they're reproaching us and casting out our name as evil for the Son of Man's sake. Well, are we then no longer blameless when that happens? Well, no. They're saying something against us for Christ's sake. It's because we're doing what Christ says that they're saying these things. So it's not true in the sense of being accusing us of something that we've really done wrong. It's a false accusation. It's persecution. That's a different situation. Verse 26, on the other hand, says, "Woe unto you when all men shall speak well of you, for so did their fathers to the false prophets." That's why we're approved of God as his minister by good report and by evil report. If everybody only gives a good report, that's not a good sign. When we're living like we should as a Christian, and if we're testifying that the deeds of this world are evil, and if we're standing for the truth, there's some people aren't going to like that. There's some people aren't going to appreciate that, and we're going to find ourselves persecuted. That's a promise of God, as we know. 2 Timothy chapter 2, or 3, verse 12, for one thing. There are several other passages, of course, that promise that. But when he talks about being blameless, we understand that he's referring to not being rightfully accused of some wrongdoing. And again, that word in Titus chapter 1 is a little bit different. It means unaccused or unreproachable. And I'd like for us to look at a couple of places where that word is used. It's a little bit different than that word that where our English word epilepsy comes from, the seizing part. We're to be unseized, blameless in that sense. Well, here in Titus 1, unaccused, and that word accused is to call in as a debt or a demand, to be called into question. And we still use that phrase like that, and that's literally what that word is saying. Well, here we're to be blameless, not to be able to be called into question for something. Again, called into question, not just talking about a false accusation, but rightfully called into question. Let's look at a couple of places where that word is also used. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 8. And again, we'll see that this word is used in the general sense for what all Christians should be. But Colossians 1, I hope I didn't write down the wrong thing here. Verse 22. He says, "In the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and unblameable and unreprovable in his sight." Well, that word unreprovable is the same word that's given for a qualification for elders in God's church there in Titus chapter 1. But again, this is what he wants us all to be as Christians, to be holy, unblameable, and unreprovable in his sight. So that's the key point, that this is in the Lord's sight. And anybody who's speaking the truth will acknowledge the same thing, that we're not able to be accused of something wrong, justifiably. And that word is also, of course, used in 1 Timothy chapter 3, in fact, when he's giving the qualifications, as he's giving further qualifications, but they're actually of the deacons. 1 Timothy 3:10, when he says, "Let these also first be proved, then let them use the office of a deacon being found blameless. Now, that word blameless is the same one that's in Titus. Well, does that apply to elders? Well, it does in Titus, but it also does here if you think about it, and that's a point we want to eventually make when we get down and in, further into 1 Timothy 3. Let these also first be proved or tested. So when he's talking about deacons and he says, let these also, anything he says that a deacon has to be, that will be their qualification, are they going to have any qualifications that are going to be stricter or beyond what an elder should be? No, they won't. And so whatever he's saying about them, they should also be tested in these things. Well, an elder is going to be at least that, and of course much beyond, as we're going to see. But whatever the qualifications of a deacon are, the elders have to at least be that, and he uses that word blameless there. And that's also why he says they also must be first proved. And even then in verse 11, even so must their wives be. So that whatever he's saying about a deacon's wife, I mean, we're going to see that the same is going to apply for an elder's wife at the very least. So it's kind of interesting how some of that ties together. But he uses the word blameless, that word from Titus, also there in 1 Timothy 3 and verse 10. He's going to repeat it in Titus chapter 1 and verse 7, which is kind of an interesting thing too. Is he saying, well, an elder has to be blameless two times over? Well, he says, if any be blameless in verse 6, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of right or unruly, for a bishop must be blameless as the steward of God. Well, in verse 7, you can see there's a particular application that's another way in which the elder is to be blameless, particularly as the steward of God. So blameless, period, or generally, but also in regard to his stewardship. And we will have the opportunity to go into more of a study of that when we start looking at the family, because that's what that's really tied into. But really, as a steward, and we're going to see that elders have, they're going to have stewardship as watching for the souls of the congregation, but they also have stewardship over the funds, over the finances of the congregation. And would it be a very good thing? Would it be a wise thing to put somebody in, as an elder that has is questionable in the way that they handle their stewardship over their own affairs and things? I mean, what's going to happen if a man is not blameless as a steward over the things in his own life? What's going to happen if he's then put as a steward over these things that are the Lord's of the church? There's a reason why he says they have to be blameless and blameless as stewards of God. There has to be that qualification in relation to being a good steward. Well, this is also going to require then for a person who is an elder to be very careful about all of their behavior in every situation. They're going to have to be thinking about, well, how's this going to come across to others, to the members of the body, and to anyone else as well. Romans chapter 12, verse 17, again, this is something that he's writing to all Christians, but elders for certain need to pay attention to this. He says, recompense to no man evil for evil. Provide things honest in the sight of all men. That word honest is the word good, as in the way its appearance is. Not good in the inherently good sense, which, of course, we have to do that too. But he's particularly approaching this from the way it's going to come across to others. But we need to provide for things honest in the sight of all men. We need to be thinking about what we're doing and how that's going to come across to other people, to everyone. And if we're doing something that could be misconstrued, misunderstood, or it could come across in some way that somebody may accuse us or blame us for something, even if it's wrongly. Well, if we've done something, it kind of ties in with that abstaining from all appearance of evil. If we're doing something that's going to make it look questionable to people, then we're really not making wise choices about what we're doing. We need to be very careful about that. He says the same thing in 2 Corinthians 8:21. There, in regard particularly to dealing with finances and how, not just how money is spent, but how it's conducted. And in 2 Corinthians 8, when they were collecting money from all the different churches and they were going to carry it back to Judea and Jerusalem, they didn't send it back in just the hands of one person. They chose, all the churches designated a particular brother to accompany the ones that were going to be carrying it to make sure there was more than one person carrying back the money. Well, why? Is there a reason for that? And that's why in 2 Corinthians 8, verse 21 says they were doing that. Avoiding this, he says in verse 20, that no man should blame us in this abundance which is administered by us, providing for honest things not only in the sight of the Lord, but also in the sight of men. Well, if you got one person carrying a lot of money like that, what might some people start thinking? And it's not necessarily that they would rightfully be accusing this brother of being dishonest. There's a reason also why we had two people to count the money here. It's a prudent thing to do. It's a way to avoid any question about things. If you have more than one involved with the handling of the finances and the money and all of that, and there are safeguards in place like that, is to keep everything above board, is to keep everything out in the open where nobody's going to be able to rightfully accuse and suspect somebody of something. So we have to think like that in all of our behavior, but also in terms of our stewardship and whatever it is that's God has put into our hands. And so an elder has to be blameless in all of those things. And it looks like we've exhausted the time here tonight. I'm going to squeeze in one more qualification real quick that's also in 1 Timothy chapter 3, as well as in Titus chapter 1, the next one, the husband of one wife. The reason I think we can squeeze that one in is because there's really not much to misunderstand about that if we're looking at the words there. That leaves no room for elderettes. It also leaves no room, and this is something, this was quite a few years ago, congregation in Florida that I knew well, they didn't have elders, and so they went through a series. The preacher there gave a series of lessons on the eldership. My grandmother was, this was down in Florida where she attended, went through a study of all these things about the eldership. They were doing it the way it's usually done, where it was kind of under the gun, where they were preparing immediately then to put men forward for that position, which is not what we're doing right now. But they were doing that. And so right after all the teaching about it, they put names forward. And there was one young man in the church who was very active and was a good person. But there were a couple of people that put his name forward as an elder. I mean, he was in his early 20s, wasn't married or anything. And it just made you think, were they paying any attention whatsoever to the teaching of those lessons? The husband of one wife, it means it has to be a man, and it has to be a married man to one wife. And that should be pretty clear. So it doesn't leave room for a single man to be an elder. It doesn't leave room for a woman to be an elder. And it doesn't leave room for, when it says the husband of one wife, well, the area where this kind of becomes controversial at some point is, what if a man is in the office of an elder, qualified, been there for a long time, and then his wife passes away? That's where it becomes a practical question, usually, where it comes up. Well, is he still somebody that should be serving in the capacity of an elder at that point? Well, as far as his personal qualifications, that shouldn't have changed as far as what kind of person he is himself. But is there a reason why God says that it needs to be a married man that's holding that office? And as we look forward, we'll see, and particularly when we look at the qualifications of the family, but there's reasons why God chose it that way. Elders are going to be involved in the shepherding of all the souls, overseeing all of the souls, men and women. Well, what happens when an elder has to go visit one of the female members of the church for reasons of trying to edify or encourage, or maybe in certain cases to have to go visit her about a problem area? Well, whatever it is, I mean, is it going to look really good if you've got the elder alone with another woman that's not his wife? And I mean, there's some prudent reasons, again, going along with things we've already looked at, why doing things good in the sight of all men. If he's got a wife and he goes with his wife, and you've got, then everything is above board there. It just provides a way of doing the job and doing it right. And there's a reason why the women have to have certain qualifications too. But there are going to be times when an elder's going to have his wife along. And there are going to be certain situations, if he doesn't have a wife, that it's going to be it's going to compromise his ability to carry out the duties of that office in the right way. The fact is, he makes that a qualification. He has to be the husband of one wife. And so in that case where he no longer is the husband of one wife, he's no longer meeting that qualification. And so it's sad when that happens, but sometimes it does. And an elder who served well, but if he becomes a widower, then he has to step down. But at any rate, that is a qualification that the elders be the husband of one wife. That's repeated in Titus also, and so it's in both places. But we'll stop for there tonight. A lot more to look at there. A few more before we look at that lesson. I have an entire lesson on the family itself, so a lot more to look at on these things. It's good for us to go through it. I know it can be a bit tedious, but it really shouldn't be that way to us, as we're learning a lot of these words and learning about a lot of good things that we as Christians need to do, that elders must be in order to qualify for the office that God has designated for them.